Section 8 of the Library of the World's Best Literature, Ancient and Modern, Volume 1. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by J. Martin. Library of the World's Best Literature, Ancient and Modern, Volume 1, Section 8. Letters to Her Husband by Abigail Adams. Abigail Adams, 1744 to 1818, by Lucia Gilbert Runkle. The Constitution of the State of Massachusetts, adopted in the year 1780, contains an article for the encouragement of literature, which, it declares, should be fostered because its influence is to countenance and inculcate the principles of humanity and general benevolence, public and private charity, industry and frugality, honesty and punctuality in dealings, sincerity and good humor, and all social affections and generous sentiments among the people. In these words, as in a mirror, is reflected the Massachusetts of the 18th century, where households like the Adamses, the Warrens, the Otises, made the standard of citizenship. 6 years before this remarkable document was framed, Abigail Adams had written to her husband, then engaged in nation-making in Philadelphia. I most sincerely wish that some more liberal plan might be laid in adapting Scripture to several exigencies, and throughout the Revolution he astonished his hearers by the peculiar fitness of his texts to political uses. It is related of him that when his eldest daughter married Richard Cranch, he preached to his people from Luke, 10th chapter, 42nd verse, "And Mary hath chosen that good part which shall not be taken away from her." When a year later young John Adams came courting the brilliant Abigail, the parish, which assumed a right to be heard in the question of the destiny of the minister's daughter, grimly objected. He was upright, singularly abstemious, studious, but he was poor. He was the son of a small farmer, and she was of the gentry. He was hot-headed and somewhat tactless, and offended his critics. Worst of all, he was a lawyer, and the prejudices of colonial society reckoned a lawyer hardly honest. He won this most important of his cases, however, and Parson Smith's marriage sermon for the bride of 19 was preached from the text, "For John came neither eating bread nor drinking wine, and ye say he hath a devil." For 10 years Mrs. Adams seems to have lived a most happy life, either in Boston or Braintree, her greatest grief being the frequent absences of her husband on circuit. His letters to her are many and delightful, expressing again and again, in the somewhat formal phrases of the period, his affection and admiration. She wrote seldom. Her household duties and the care of the children, of whom there were 4 in 10 years, occupying her busy hands. Meanwhile the clouds were growing black in the political sky. Mr. Adams wrote arguments and appeals in the news journals over Latin signatures, papers of instructions to representatives in the general court, and legal portions of the controversy between the delegates and Governor Hutchinson. In all this work Mrs. Adams constantly sympathized and advised. In August of 1774 he went to Philadelphia as a delegate to a general council of the colonies called to concert measures for united action. And now begins the famous correspondence, which goes on for a period of 9 years, which was intended to be seen only by the eyes of her husband, which she begs him again and again to destroy as not worth the keeping, yet which has given her a name and place among the world's most charming letter-writers. Her courage, her cheerfulness, her patriotism, her patience never fail her. Braintree, where, with her little brood, she is to stay, is close to the British lines. Raids and foraging expeditions are imminent. Hopes of a peaceful settlement grow dim. "What course you can or will take," she writes her husband, "is all wrapped in the bosom of futurity. Uncertainty and expectation leave the mind great scope. Did ever any kingdom or state regain its liberty when once it was invaded without bloodshed? I cannot think of it without horror, yet we are told that all the misfortunes of Sparta were occasioned by their too great solicitude for present tranquillity and from an excessive love of peace they neglected the means of making it sure and lasting. They ought to have reflected, says Polybius, that as there is nothing more desirable or advantageous than peace when founded in justice and honor, so there is nothing more shameful and at the same time more pernicious when attained by bad measures and purchased at the price of liberty. Thus, in the high Roman fashion, she faces danger, yet her sense of fun never deserts her, and in the very next letter she writes, parodying her husband's documents, "The drought has become very severe. My poor cows will certainly prefer a petition to you, setting forth their grievances, and informing you that they have been deprived of their ancient privileges, whereby they are become great sufferers, and desiring that these may be restored to them, more especially as their living, by reason of the drought, is all taken from them, and their property, which they hold elsewhere, is decaying. They humbly pray that you would consider them, lest hunger should break through stone walls." By midsummer, the small hardships entailed by the British occupation of Boston were most vexatious. "We shall very soon have no coffee, no sugar, nor pepper, but whortleberries and milk we are not obliged to commence for," she writes, and in letter after letter she begs for pins. Needles are desperately needed, but without pins how can domestic life go on, and not a pin in the province? On the 14th of September, she describes the excitement in Boston, the governor mounting cannon on Beacon Hill, digging entrenchments on the Neck, planting guns, throwing up breastworks, and camping a regiment. In consequence of the powder being taken from Charlestown, she goes on to say a general alarm spread through all the towns and was soon caught in Braintree. And then she describes one of the most extraordinary scenes in history. About 8 o'clock on Sunday evening, she writes to her husband, "At least 200 men, preceded by a horse cart, passed by her door in dead silence and marched down to the powder house, whence they took out the town's powder, because they dared not trust it where there were so many Tories, carried it into the other parish, and there secreted it. On their way they captured a notorious king's man, and found on him 2 warrants aimed at the Commonwealth. When their patriotic trust was discharged, they turned their attention to the trembling Briton. Profoundly excited and indignant though they were, they never thought of mob violence, but, true to the inherited instincts of their race, they resolved themselves into a public meeting. The hostile warrants being produced and exhibited, it was put to a vote whether they should be burned or preserved. The majority voted for burning them. Then the 200 gathered in a circle round the single lantern and maintained a rigid silence while the offending papers were consumed. That done, the blazing eyes in that grim circle of patriots watched the blazing writs. They called a vote whether they should huzza, but it being Sunday evening, it passed in the negative. Only in the New England of John Winthrop and the Mathers, of John Quincy and the Adamses, would such a scene have been possible. A land of self-conquest and self-control, of a deep love of the public welfare and a willingness to take trouble for a public object. A little later, Mrs. Adams writes her husband that there has been a conspiracy among the Negroes, though it has been kept quiet. "I wish most sincerely," she adds, "that there was not a slave in the province. It always appeared a most iniquitous scheme to me to fight ourselves for what we are daily robbing and plundering from those who have as good a right to freedom as we have." Nor were the sympathies of this clever logician confined to the slaves. A month or two before the Declaration of Independence was made, she writes her constructive statesman, "I long to hear that you have declared independence, and by the way, in the new code of laws which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies, and be more gracious and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion, and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. That your sex are naturally tyrannical is a truth so thoroughly established as to admit of no dispute, but such of you as wish to be happy willingly give up the harsh title of master for the more tender and daring one of friend? Why, then, not put it out of the power of the vicious and lawless to use us with cruelty and indignity with impunity? Men of sense, in all ages, abhor those customs which treat us only as the vassals of your sex. Regard us, then, as being placed by Providence under your protection, and, in imitation of the Supreme Being, make use of that power only for our happiness. A declaration of principles which the practical housewives follow by saying, I have not yet attempted making saltpeter, but after soap-making, believe I shall make the experiment. I find as much as I can do to manufacture clothing for my family, which would else be naked. I have lately seen a small manuscript describing the proportions of the various sorts of powder fit for cannon, small arms, and pistols. If it would be of any service your way, I will get it transcribed and send it to you. She is interested in everything, and she writes about everything in the same wholehearted way. Farming, paper money, the making of molasses from corn stalks, the new remedy of inoculation, common sense and its author, the children's handwriting, the state of Harvard College, the rate of taxes, the most helpful methods of enlistment, Chesterfield's letters, the town elections, the higher education of women, and the getting of homespun enough for Mr. Adams's new suit. She manages with astonishing skill to keep the household in comfort. She goes through trials of sickness, death, agonizing suspense, and ever with the same heroic cheerfulness that her anxious husband may be spared the pangs which she endures. When he is sent to France and Holland, she accepts the new parting as another service pledged to her country. She sees her darling boy of 10 go with his father, aware that at the best she must bear months of silence, knowing that they may perish at sea or fall into the hands of privateers. But she writes with indomitable cheer, sending the lad tender letters of good advice, a little didactic to modern taste, but throbbing with affection. "Dear as you are to me," says this tender mother, "I would much rather you should have found your grave in the ocean you have crossed than see you an immoral, profligate, or graceless child." It was the lot of this country's parson's daughter to spend 3 years in London as wife of the first American minister, to see her husband vice-president of the United States for 8 years and president for 4, and to greet her son as the eminent Monroe's valued Secretary of State, though she died 74 years young before he became President. She could not, in any station, be more truly a lady than when she made soap and chopped kindling on her Braintree farm. At Braintree she was no more simply modest than that at the court of St. James or in the Executive Mansion. Her letters exactly reflect her ardent, sincere, and energetic nature. She shows a charming delight when her husband tells her that his affairs could not possibly be better managed than she manages them, and that she shines not less as a statesman than as a farmeress. And although she was greatly admired and complimented, no praise so pleased her as his declaration that for all the ingratitude, calumnies, and misunderstandings that he had endured, and they were numberless, her perfect comprehension of him had been his sufficient compensation. To her husband, Braintree, May 24, 1775. My dearest friend, our house has been, upon this alarm, in the same scene of confusion that it was upon the former. Soldiers coming in for a lodging, for breakfast, for supper, for drink, etc. Sometimes refugees from Boston, tired and fatigued, seek an asylum for a day, a night, a week. You can hardly imagine how we live, yet. To the houseless child of want our doors are open still, and though our portions are but scant, we give them with good will. My best wishes attend you, both for your health and happiness, and that you may be directed into the wisest and best measures for our safety and the safety of our posterity. I wish you were nearer to us. We know not what a day will bring forth, nor what distress 1 hour may throw us into. Hitherto I have been able to maintain a calmness and presence of mind, and hope I shall, let the exigency of the time be what it will. Adieu. Breakfast calls. Your affectionate Portia. Weymouth, June 15, 1775. I hope we shall see each other again, and rejoice together in happier days. The little ones are well, and send duty to Papa. Don't fail of letting me hear from you by every opportunity. Every line is like a precious relic of the saints. I have a request to make of you, something like the barrel of sand, I suppose you will think it, but really of much more importance to me. It is that you would send out Mr. Bass, and purchase me a bundle of pins and put them in your trunk for me. The cry for pins is so great that what I used to buy for 7 shillings and 6 pence are now 20 shillings, and not to be had for that. A bundle contains 6,000, for which I used to give a dollar. But if you can procure them for 50 shillings or 3 pounds, pray let me have them. I am, with the tenderest regard, your Portia. Braintree, June 18, 1775. My dearest friend, the day, perhaps the decisive day, has come on which the fate of America depends. My bursting heart must find vent at my pen. I have just heard that our dear friend Dr. Warren is no more, but fell gloriously fighting for his country, saying, "Better to die honorably in the field than ignominiously hang upon the gallows." Great is our loss. He has distinguished himself in every engagement by his courage and fortitude, by animating the soldiers and leading them by his own example. A particular account of these dreadful, but I hope glorious, days will be transmitted to you, no doubt, in the exactest manner. The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, but the God of Israel is he that giveth strength and power unto his people. Trust in him at all times, ye people. Pour out your hearts before him. God is a refuge for us. Charleston is laid in ashes. The battle began upon our entrenchments upon Bunker's Hill Saturday morning about 3 o'clock, and has not ceased yet, and it is now 3 o'clock Sabbath afternoon. It is expected they will come out over the neck to-night, and a dreadful battle must ensue. Almighty God, cover the heads of our countrymen, and be a shield to our dear friends. How many have fallen we know not. The constant roar of the canyon is so distressing that we cannot eat, drink, or sleep. May we be supported and sustained in the dreadful conflict. I shall tarry here till it is thought unsafe by my friends, and then I have secured myself a retreat at your brother's, who has kindly offered me part of his house. I cannot compose myself to write any further at present. I will add more as I hear further. Your Portia. Braintree, November 27, 1775. Colonel Warren returned last week to Plymouth, so that I shall not hear anything from you until he goes back again, which will not be till the last of this month. He damped my spirits greatly by telling me that the court had procured your stay another month. I was pleasing myself with the thought that you would soon be upon your return. It is vain to repine. I hope the public will reap what I sacrifice. I wish I knew what mighty things were fabricating. If a form of government is to be established here, what one will be assumed? Will it be left to our assemblies to choose one? And will not many men have many minds? And shall we not run into dissensions among ourselves? I am more and more convinced that man is a dangerous creature, and that power, whether vested in many or few, is ever grasping, and, like the grave, cries, "Give, give!" The great fish swallow up the small, and he who is most strenuous for the rights of the people, when vested with power, is as eager after the prerogatives of government. You tell me of degrees of perfection to which human nature is capable of arriving, and I believe it, but at the same time lament that our admiration should arise from the scarcity of the instances. The building up a great empire, which was only hinted at by my correspondent, may now, I suppose, be realized even by the unbelievers. Yet will not 10,000 difficulties arrive in the formation of it? The reins of government have been so long slackened that I fear the people will not quietly submit to those restraints which are necessary for the peace and security of the community. If we separate from Britain, what code of laws will be established? How shall we be governed so as to retain our liberties? Can any government be free which is not administered by general stated laws? Who shall frame the laws? Who will give them force and energy? It is true, your resolutions as a body have hitherto had the force of laws, but will they continue to have? When I consider these things and the prejudices of people in favor of ancient customs and regulations, I feel anxious for the fate of our monarchy or democracy or whatever is to take place. I soon get lost in the labyrinth of perplexities, but whatever occurs, may justice and righteousness be the stability of our times, and order arise out of confusion. Great difficulties may be surmounted by patience and perseverance. I believe I have tired you with politics. As to news, we have not any at all. I shudder at the approach of winter when I think I am to remain desolate. I must bid you good night. 'Tis late for me, who am much of an invalid. I was disappointed last week in receiving a packet by post, and upon unsealing it, finding only 4 newspapers. I think you are more cautious than you need be. All letters, I believe, have come safe to hand. I have 16 from you, and wish I had as many more. Your Portia. Braintree, April 20th, 1777. There is a general cry against the merchants, against monopolizers, etc., who, 'tis said, have created a partial scarcity, that a scarcity prevails of every article, not only of luxury, but even the necessities of life, is a certain fact. Everything bears an exorbitant price. The Act, which was in some measure regarded and stemmed the torrent of oppression, is now no more heeded than if it had never been made. Indian corn at 5 shillings, rye 11 and 12 shillings, but scarcely any to be had even at that price. Beef 8 pence, veal 6 pence, and 8 pence butter, 1 and 6 pence mutton, none lamb, none pork, none mean sugar, 4 pounds per 100, molasses none, cotton wool none, New England rum 8 shillings per gallon, coffee 2 and 6 pence per pound, chocolate 3 shillings. What can be done? Will gold and silver remedy this evil? By your accounts of board, housekeeping, etc., I fancy that you are not better off than we are here. I live in hopes that we see the most difficult time we have had to experience. Why is Carolina so much better furnished than any other state, and at so reasonable prices? Your Portia. Braintree, June 8, 1779. 6 months have already elapsed since I heard a syllable from you or my dear son, and 5 since I have had 1 single opportunity of conveying a line to you. Letters of various dates have lain months at the Navy Board, and a packet and frigate, both ready to sail at an hour's warning, have been months waiting the orders of Congress. They no doubt have their reasons, or ought to have, for detaining them. I must patiently wait their motions, however painful it is. And that it is so, your own feelings will testify. Yet I know not, but you are less a sufferer than you would be to hear from us, to know our distresses, and yet be unable to relieve them. The universal cry for bread to a humane heart is painful beyond description, and the great price demanded and given for it verifies that pathetic passages of sacred writ. All that a man hath will he give for his life. Yet he who miraculously fed a multitude with 5 loaves and 2 fishes has graciously interposed in our favor, and delivered many of the enemy's supplies into our hands, so that our distresses have been mitigated. I have been able as yet to supply my own family, sparingly, but at a price that would astonish you. Corn is sold at $4, hard money, per bushel, which is equal to 80 at the rate of exchange. Labor is at $8 per day, and in 3 weeks it will be at 12, it is probable, or it will be more stable than anything else. Goods of all kinds are at such a price that I hardly dare mention it. Linens are sold at $20 per yard, the most ordinary sort of calicoes at 30 and 40, broadcloths at 40 pounds per yard, West India goods full as high, molasses at $20 per gallon, sugar $4 per pound, bohea tea at $40, and our own produce in proportion, butcher's meat at 6 and 8 shillings per pound, board at $50 and $60 per week, rates high. That I suppose you will rejoice at, so would I, did it remedy the evil. I pay $500, and a new continental rate has just appeared, my proportion of which will be 200 more. I have come to this determination to sell no more bills unless I can procure hard money for them, although I shall be obliged to allow a discount. If I sell for paper, I throw away more than half, so rapid is the depreciation, nor do I know that it will be received long. I sold a bill to Blodgett at 5 for 1, which was looked upon as high at the time. The week after I received it, 2 emissions were taken out of circulation, and the greater part of what I had proved to be of that sort, so that those to whom I was indebted are obliged to wait, and before it becomes due or is exchanged, it will be good for as much as it will fetch, which will be nothing. If it goes on as it has done for this 3 months past, I will not tire your patience any longer. I have not drawn any further upon you. I mean to wait the return of the alliance, which, with longing eyes, I look for. God grant it may bring me comfortable tidings from my dear, dear friend, whose welfare is so essential to my happiness that it is entwined around my heart and cannot be impaired or separated from it without rending it asunder. I cannot say that I think our affairs go very well here. Our currency seems to be the source of all our evils. We cannot fill up our continental army by means of it. No bounty will prevail with them. What can be done with it? It will sink in less than a year. The advantage the enemy daily gains over us is owing to this. Most truly did you prophesy when you said that they would do all the mischief in their power with the forces they had here. My tenderest regards ever attend you. In all places and situations, know me to be ever, ever yours. End of Section 8. Recording by J. Martin.